עם אות הפתיחה הרגיל שלנו.
הקצה משודרת מול פני BPM, המכללה של תעשיית המוסיקה. אתם עכשיו. על הקצה. אתם עכשיו.
אתם עכשיו. על הקצה.
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 Welcome. I'm so glad you could come. This is going to be such an exciting day. I hope you enjoy it.
Isn't it about time for somebody's favorite radio program?
Radio, what the fuck?
Movies is magic.
Yeah.
CinemaScope, CinemaScope in Yair Raven.
Radio Rahim.
So yeah, that's the world.
That's the radio.
This is the radio.
אהלן, סינמסקופ ברדיו הקצה, כאן יאיר רווה, תוכנית 144, תודה רבה שבאתם. את רדיו הקצה עושים עומר סנש, לאה שפיגל, בר זוודה, ספיר כהן, חוכה כהן, אורי קדישאית, תומר נוללס, תודה למכללת BPM, תודה לקואמי, תודה לבן אש, מפיק השידור. ותודה לסינמטק הרצליה ולאלון גוריה שבזכותם התוכנית היום מתאפשרת. איתי באולפן אורח מיוחד, תכף נעבור לדבר באנגלית, הוא לא יודע מה אני אומר כרגע. איתי באולפן דיוויד זוקר, הבמאי של טיסה נעימה והאקדח מצחוק וסודי ביותר ועוד ועוד, אחד משלישיית זוקר, אברהם זוקר. ועכשיו נעביר, נדליק את המיקרופון גם שלו. Hi, David. Thank you for
Hello.
Coming. Hi.
Sure.
You have to speak really close to the mic.
Yes. How about now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for coming on our show.
That was very nice of me to come on the show, I thought.
Don't
you think? Yeah.
Many people hear it all around the world.
No, it's actually my pleasure, and I love your studio. So.
Yeah, it's really nice and cozy here.
People don't realize how amazing this is. It's the size of 2 football fields and bigger than I thought.
Yeah, you're sitting really, really far away from me.
And I thought she was going to say sitting too far from the mic.
From me, because of the studio field.
Right. We can shout.
We just started to talk, and I said, wait, let's talk when the mic is open. It's not the first time you're in Israel. When was the first time?
I've been here twice before, and the first time was in 1969, and I spent a week on a kibbutz, Ashdot Yaakov.
Okay, yeah, near the Kinneret.
Yes, and then I toured, you know, Tel Aviv, you know, Jerusalem, did the whole tour for another week after that. And then I went back to Greece, Italy, and toured Europe.
Okay. And then?
But no one interviewed me at that time.
Nobody knew. You were
a
youngster.
Nobody cared, yeah. Okay. So, how about, yeah. And the next time I was here was 82.
Okay. But not as a filmmaker, you went.
You
made films, but nobody knew that you were here.
Nobody knew that I was. I probably should have told someone.
Yeah,
yeah.
No, I know. I was 15
it
then.
It didn't
or 14.
Okay, well, so that's why I didn't call you. But it didn't even occur to me that maybe somebody would want to talk to me.
Yeah.
So yeah.
So by now you probably know, because you met Alon, you met the audience at the Herzliya Cinematek, that your films are very well known here.
I know.
In Israel.
I was completely surprised. People knew every detail. They know Airplane, Top Secret.
Right. Yeah. One of the things that I thought that I would do here was just to recite by heart Airplane from beginning to the end by myself, and you'd applaud at the end.
I would love that, although you would probably lose your audience.
Right. But just to tell you how much those films, Airplane, Top Secret, Naked Gun, but for mostly Airplane, which was the first of the films that I saw from you, and later I saw Kentucky Fried Movie, which celebrates its 40th anniversary right about now.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah, it's 1977.
Yes,
77. So you've made some of the funniest films I've ever seen in my life. And at that time, I was a teenager. That time it was U3 and Monty Python and Mel Brooks. That's the things that made me laugh the most. And I think I'm not the only one in Israel that would say that. Oh. And just now we heard, we saw the BBC list of the 100 best comedies in
the
world.
Yeah, evidently we made the list somewhere.
Yeah, number 7, Airplane.
Number 7, yes.
And I wrote it down. Naked Gun is number 72 and Top Secret, number 82. So
well,
all three
that's
films.
That's nice to know, yeah.
Yeah, so not only I think that Airplane is great in all your films. So we'll talk a little bit about movie making, but as I said, all those three films when I was a teenager made me laugh the hardest. What made you laugh the hardest when you were
actually,
growing up?
You know, growing up, what made us laugh the hardest were serious movies. So we would watch these B movies. Like there's a movie called Zero Hour, which had the exact plot of Airplane. You know, pilot, okay. A guy goes up, he was a former pilot, all stressed out and afraid of flying, and there's food poisoning and he has to fly down the plane. And so, you know, we thought it was so hilarious. We would redub movies like that and just put our own voices in. So I think for Airplane, we decided, why don't we just remake the movie with serious actors? And so that became the whole concept.
Okay.
And then the challenge was to try to convince anybody to back it. So, of course, every studio turned down the script.
So there were no movie comedies when you were growing up
we liked Mel Brooks, Monty Python, Woody Allen when he made funny movies,
right.
Three Stooges, Marx Brothers. We loved all that stuff.
Right. And
Laurel and Hardy, I guess. Yeah.
And then the three of you, it's you and your brother, Jerry, and Jim Abrams.
And Jim Abrams.
You set up the Kentucky Fried Theater.
Yeah,
What was that all about?
We did a review sketch comedy, a 90-minute show, and had an intermission. And we did that on the campus of the University of Wisconsin, where we all graduated. And then after a year, it was very successful, but we could only charge $1 a ticket. Our goal was to charge $2 a ticket. So we moved to Los Angeles and we set up in an old abandoned warehouse, you know, hammered and nailed a theater together. And that was successful too. We did our first show was called My Nose, so that in our weekly listing in the Los Angeles Times, it said, My Nose runs continuously. So that's all sorts of stuff we did to try to gin up some audience.
And how did you move from Kentucky Fried Theater to the Kentucky Fried Movie?
Yeah, we did Kentucky Fried Theater for about 5 years and then scraped enough money to do 10 minutes of Kentucky Fried Movie, which was conveniently possible because it was made up of 22 sketches. We did four of them for the 10 minutes. And that we took to this exhibitor chain called United Artists Theater Circuit, and they put in the $600,000 to make the movie, and I think it made $1 million its first weekend, so they made their money back.
And the guy who directed it was John Landis.
Yes, we found John Landis because he's the only director we knew. He had done one unsuccessful movie called Schlock, and he was writing additional dialogue in James Bond movies for the Broccolis. They were producing them at Fox, which is only a couple of blocks from our theater.
That's way before Blues Brothers and Animal House.
Yeah, no, he was out of the business when we found him. And so he helped us, you know, reorder and rewrite some of Kentucky Fried Movie. And it was a good collaboration. We enjoyed working with him. But having that experience, and we had never been on a movie set before, we realized that we needed to direct. So for Airplane, we insisted on directing it.
Okay, so how do you direct in a trio? You're three people on set.
Yeah, well, when people ask us this when we're on stage, we all start talking at once. But, you know, what we did was one of us would talk to the actors, and that was Jerry in the first couple of movies. And then we'd confer in between takes and figure out if we wanted to do another take or what we needed to fix it.
Mm-hmm. He would talk to, and you two.
Jerry would relay the instructions to the actors.
To the actors, okay.
So they weren't
be the audience, like for the performances.
Yeah, Jim and I would watch the monitor, just okay. Whatever would be the camera would see, we would see.
And after Airplane, movie spoofs became very popular, but by then, you were the first making films, feature films, that are a mockery of film genres and film.
Right.
Film. How did you persuade the studio or anybody or the producer to give money to something that I think was not seen before? You knew sketch comedy,
yes.
but movie spoofs?
Well, the script was funny, But still, every studio turned it down. We had a pitch meeting at Warner Brothers where the guy loved us and loved the idea. Sounds great. And then he read the script and nope, or had a reader read it. But Michael Eisner, the head of Paramount, was at a dinner party and asked everybody at the dinner party if they had read anything decent. And this one script reader named Susan Bearwald, who was a screen, she was a reader for United Artists. And she said, well, there was one movie by these guys who did Kentucky Fried Movie, and it's called Airplane. And I think that's all Eisner had to hear was a comedy on an airplane. And I think he figured, well, this must be Animal House on an airplane. I mean, it wasn't, but he had us in there, and so we ended up at Paramount. So somebody at Paramount read it and liked it enough to have us do a rewrite, and we proceeded to rewrite it once we were at Paramount. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if many people nowadays know or remember that in the 70s, disaster movies were a big deal.
Yes, and Eisner had produced a lot of them at ABC Television. They did movies of the week.
Yeah, so there was Airport, and then Airport 75, and so on and so forth.
Yes,
and so you would be like the remake or the sequel, but for fun.
But for fun, and after people were used to all these serious airplane dramas, they shared all the references and all the cliches. Right. So all we had to do was do it and, you know, play it straight and do the gags. So
let's hear a small gag from Airplane. I hope it works on radio, but I think it will. Okay. Here's from Airplane.
Excuse me, sir. There's been a little problem in the cockpit.
The cockpit? What is it?
It's the little room in the front of the plane where the pilots sit. That's not important right now. You see, the first officer is ill, and the captain needs someone to help him with the radio. Do you know anything about planes?
Well, I flew in the war, but it was years ago. I wouldn't know anything about it.
Would you go up, please?
Stewardess said both pilots.
Can you fly this plane and land it?
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious, and don't call me Shirley.
Doctor, I've checked everyone. Mr. Stryker's the only one.
What flying experience have you had?
Well, I flew single-engine fighters in the Air Force, but this plane has four engines. It's an entirely different kind of flying altogether.
It's an entirely different kind of flying.
Yeah, that's from Airplane. And let's talk about writing comedy a little bit, because I think that these days when you go to film school and you write a comedy, they tell you no word plays and no puns.
Well, that's the first mistake is ever going to film school.
Okay.
So, you know, we just ignored all the rules and whatever the rules were and did what we thought was funny. And what we used to do is, you know, redub, you know, these serious movies. So all we were doing is recast it with serious actors.
But maybe I think that what they meant, those film teachers, is that language or verbal comedy doesn't travel very well.
And especially puns.
Puns, right.
But, you know, I think Airplane probably had enough visual comedy to make it. But, you know, one thing about that scene that you just played, you know, it was Leslie Nielsen saying, I am serious and don't call me Shirley. That was done the very first day of filming. And Paramount, the studio, in our deal said that they could fire us after 1 week because it was, you know, we were first time directors and three directors at once was unheard of. So after they saw that, they got it. And the other thing about that scene, and especially since there were about 10 seconds of just the engine noise. You know, we wanted to do the movie in black and white and on a prop plane. But Michael Eisner, the head of Paramount, said, oh, no way, you're doing it on a jet and in color. So we caved in, of course. But the sound of the engines, although it wasn't, the plane is a jet, is you can hear it was the piston engine.
Propeller plane. So you would write puns and word plays, and one of the big differences between Airplane and Top Secret, I think, is Top Secret has much more visual humor.
More visual humor.
Much more, I think, because I tried to watch some of
it. We loved to do, you know, cinematic tricks. You know, there was a little bit of it in Airplane. There was one scene where Robert Stack walks through a mirror.
Okay.
And it's just, we just like that kind of weirdness. And in Top Secret, we were able to just do whatever we wanted. Like we had, instead of the train leaving the station leaves the train.
Right.
And, you know, there's some other visual tricks in it too.
The reason I'm saying it, because it's much harder for me to play clips from Top Secret because you can't play on radio the Swedish Bookshop.
Right, that's
right.
You
have to see it.
Yeah, you have to see it. And so that was a whole scene of a trick. But, you know, the interesting thing is that, you know, we couldn't just rest on just the concept. We had to do jokes within the scene.
Yeah.
And so that's what we call knocking down the posts.
Oh.
From Airplane, when the girl runs along the train. Yeah. We thought we'd get a big laugh just at the fact that she was running along a plane. So, but when we didn't get a laugh until she actually knocks down the posts.
Okay. So how do you write? What was the process of writing those comedies?
We would show a scene from Zero Hour first of all, we'd meet at about 10 a.m. and we'd have coffee and talk about politics. And then we'd finally get around to writing at, you know, 10:30, 10:45, and we'd play a scene from Airplane, and then
from Zero
we'd
Hour.
Write, it was Zero Hour, and then we'd have a transcript made, and then we would, you know, we would do our twist on the scene.
Yeah.
That's really how it would go every day. We'd watch a scene from Zero Hour.
And how do you calculate, you know, the jokes per minute, or how many jokes do you need to?
It just fell into a natural rhythm. It wasn't calculated so much as, you know, everything was either a joke or a setup to a joke, and everything had to follow the story. You know, we couldn't go on side trips.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, we had the stewardess singing to the little girl, and that could be labeled a side trip. And if that hadn't been funny, we could have cut it out. So, you know, we just put as many gags as we could. We filmed maybe about 10 or 15 minutes more of gags than actually got into the picture. But we'd go through a series of test screenings to determine that.
Yeah. And you'd measure the amount of laughs.
The amount of laughs. And
right.
We cut the movie to the test audiences.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
If someone, one of you thinks that, or thought that, something is funny and the rest thought that didn't. You, how was the process?
That's an advantage of having a trio, because it was always two out of three.
Okay.
But we had a concept which we actually called screaming and yelling, which is if one guy really wanted something in, we would give in. We would say, okay, let's try it, as long as, you know, we had enough camera angles so that we could cut it out.
Okay. Now, here's the question that I wanted to ask you for about 40 years. Who was the funniest one of you three?
Oh, well, me, absolutely. Of course. Well, that was an easy one.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what would Jim and Jerry say?
They would say that they each were the funniest one. Yes.
Okay.
But, you know, the truth is that, you know, the way to make a collaboration work was not to claim credit for any individual gags. If people would ask us, who wrote that gag?
Yeah, that was my next question.
My immediate answer is I did. But the truth is that, you know, we never put any value on who wrote what. And so in practice, what happened is that we actually would forget who wrote.
Right.
Like, seriously, I cannot remember who wrote that, you know, I am serious and don't call me Shirley, for instance. Mm. I can't remember who came up with it. So, and that's one way to make a collaboration work. We loved, you know, making the movie and having it be successful. And it was fine that it was a group credit.
And were there team directors before, you know, the Coen brothers came only 5 years later?
Right. No, there had never been a three-man directing team, maybe not even a two-man directing team. And the biggest problem came not from Paramount. but from the Directors Guild,
right.
The union, and they said you can't have three-man director. You only have to pick one. So we picked Jerry, and Jerry went down to the City Hall in Los Angeles, had his name legally changed to Abrahams N. Zuckers. And so the Directors Guild, we applied, and Directors Guild spat out a card from the computer saying Abrahams N. Zuckers. And when they found out about it, they were furious. But there was nothing they could do to change it. So they finally gave in.
It's a great story. Is his legal name to this day Jerry Abrahams?
Then he had it changed back.
Okay.
After the movie was a hit. Yes.
Okay. That was very kind of him, I think.
It was very generous of Jerry.
Yeah. And
we still have the Directors Guild, the card. It says Abrahams N. Zuckers. And the clapperboard that we used on the set says Abrahams N. Zuckers. Because it wasn't for about 3 weeks into shooting that we actually got the guild card saying, you know, Abrams, you know, Zucker, Abrams, Zucker. So.
Right. Okay. You may remember that the Coen brothers would sign only with one of them until very late. So
yeah, one of them produced and one of
right,
them directed.
But
yeah.
They were both directing.
Well, they
DGA have those things. I wanted to play a minute from the jive scene. You may remember it.
Sure.
This one.
I think I remember it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a long time ago.
Shit, man. That hunky muffin mess my old lady got to be running coal upside down his head, you know?
Hey, home, I can dig it. No, he ain't gonna lay no more big rap up on you, man.
I say, hey, Sky. Subba say I won't sing. Pray to Jay, I did the same old, same old. Hey.
Mac yourself a pro, slick. Gray matter back, lot performers down, not take TCB in, man.
Hey, you know what they say. See a broad to get that booty yak him. Leg her down and smack him, yak him. Cole got to be.
The jive scene. Well, let's talk about politically correctness and comedy.
I guess that's not politically correct.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
Yeah, well, we wrote it originally. We wrote, you know, the best that we could do as, you know, three Jewish guys from Milwaukee, white guys too. So the most we knew of jive was mofo, I think. And so we had this kind of crude version of it in the original script, but these two guys, they didn't necessarily know it, but they actually, I heard the story much years later that they looked up jive. They looked it up and they pieced this thing together from what they knew and what they found in their research. And they came in and auditioned doing exactly that. And we just cracked up. We just cast them on the spot.
Great. While looking up on Google, looking for clips from the movie, I ran into something that I didn't know. And I think it's so funny. I wanted to ask you if you heard it. You probably heard it. Maya Rudolph reciting the jive scene.
I saw that. She went on Conan O'Brien.
Jimmy Kimmel.
Jimmy Kimmel.
Right.
And she did the whole jive scene. Yeah.
And it was 2 years ago. And I have to play it because it's hilarious. It's so funny.
Yeah.
Maya Rudolph talking about the films of her partner, Paul Thomas Anderson. Anderson and playing Airplane to her kids and reciting the jive scene.
Yeah.
This is it.
Your husband, well, your partner or the father of your children with whom you live.
Yes.
I don't know what the hell.
I'm
going
to write that on the next form, like verbatim. Like.
On the tax form?
Yeah.
Paul Thomas Anderson is a fantastic director. Do you sit your children down and show them movies and your movies and your favorite movies?
Not our movies.
Oh, not yours.
Well, they've not seen like Boogie Nights or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. They've not.
Not yet. But we keep promising them, when you're older, you can see Daddy's movies.
Yeah.
Not yet. They haven't seen much of what I've done either. And my oldest daughter, Pearl's like, why don't we ever get to see your stuff? And I was like, because your mother has a filthy mouth. but when Pearl was a baby, we used to show her Singing in the Rain and like all these things we wanted to share with them. And then I was always like, oh, I want to show them like the comedies I loved. And then this summer we actually had an amazing opportunity because we were traveling. We were in Europe and like we were staying in a house and the only video that was in English was Airplane.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
So we showed the kids Airplane.
Oh, how old are the kids?
Well, they're 10, I have four. 10, 6, 4, and 2.
Oh, okay.
So, yes, my 2-year-old saw Airplane. The jiggling boobies next to the Jell-O. But I was so proud because my girls started quoting it, and they would come and they would pretend to be Johnny and say, like, the fog is getting thicker, and Leon's getting large. Yes!
I think probably 100 lines from that movie.
When I was in the third grade, I realized that I had memorized the jive scene.
Oh, yeah.
After he eats the bad fish.
Yeah.
And June Cleaver walks up to help out.
Do you still know, do you remember it?
Yes.
Can you do it for us?
Totally. Okay. So he goes, Shimofo, but alay, fish got me down to the bone. It's jacking me up, tag me. And then the stewardess comes over and she goes, I'm sorry, is something wrong? And his friend goes, Cutty said he can't hang. And then June Cleaver comes over and she goes, excuse me, stewardess, I speak jive. This man says he's in great pain and would like you to help him. And then she says, well, just tell him to relax and I'll be back with some medicine. Then June comes over and goes, just hang loose, blood. He's gonna get you on a rebound on a medisac. And first dude goes, what it is, big mama, I duck her rap. We ain't no dummy. And then she says, chump don't want the help, jump don't get the help. Jive ass dude ain't got no brains in the house.
The thing is, the thing that made me laugh here is because I think that everybody that's about my age or my Rudolph age, yeah, have those moments that we speak Airplane. We speak Airplane with our friends. We have a shorthand for jokes that come from Shirley or what is it, a big house with rooms and doctors in it, yeah. and we speak for almost 40 years. Your jokes and your replicas and your
I'm so glad to hear that. When somebody asks me how I take my coffee, I just automatically say I take it black like my men. So it's like kind of a knee-jerk reaction. Jim Abrams' daughter Jamie works at Jimmy Kimmel now.
Okay.
Yeah. So she says he's a very nice guy. That's good to hear.
So let's move on to Top Secret. We can't go through all your movies, but
let's go through the important ones.
Yeah. Yeah. I want Basketball too. Top Secret. After the success of Airplane, it's carte blanche. Do whatever you want.
We could really do anything we want, and in fact, we did do anything we want, and that became Top Secret. And I think we wanted to do a movie with a lot of visual gags, something that we kind of started in Airplane. And just do something as funny as we could do it, and that became Top Secret.
How did you come up with the idea of?
Well, we love those World War II spy films, the kind that were made during the war, and at the end it said, buy war bonds in this theater, mm-hmm. and they could always sneak up on the German sentries and knock them out. I mean, I often thought of, if German sentries could hear, they would have won the war. But then we also loved Elvis movies.
Right.
So, those old Elvis movies. So we combined them, and that became Top Secret.
And they're working with Val Kilmer. I don't remember. Was he a big star then? Or
no, it was his first movie ever.
Okay.
We saw him in a play called Slab Boys with Sean Penn and somebody else on Broadway, and we thought he was very talented, good looking kid, and he came and auditioned and sang some song, Chuck Berry song, and we cast him on the spot, and he was great.
Let's hear a short summary of Top Secret. Okay.
Although you can't play any of the visual
games. No, yes. So I had to find other scenes. Okay. But here's Val Kilmer summarizing the entire movie in a second.
Nick, I want to explain.
What's there to explain?
But I just want
Look,
to say that...
I'm not the first guy who fell in love with a girl he met in a restaurant who then turned out to be the daughter of a kidnapped scientist, only to lose her to a childhood lover who she'd last seen on a deserted island and who turned out 15 years later to be the leader of the French underground.
I know. It all sounds like some bad movie.
And then they look at the camera, right, suggestively.
It's actually my favorite gag from the movie, and it worked so well, you know, because we allowed time. We knew that the audience would start hooting at when she says it's a bad movie and agreeing with her. And so the characters appeared to hear that. First they go, oh, they hear something, and then they look out at the audience and break the fourth wall and then go on with the scene. They look back and go on. It's like, it worked great. And we recently played the movie. We showed it at the Sketchfest. It's a big film festival in San Francisco, packed house. And the reaction to that, when the reaction is good, they laugh all the way through that. And it happened again, just like when the movie was released. Wow. You know, that was fun for us.
So breaking the fourth wall,
yeah,
making the audience aware that they're in the movie and
yeah,
self-aware comedy.
Yeah.
Would you advise on doing it?
I wouldn't advise doing it, but you know, we have these 15 rules of comedy, and you know, the 15th rule is there are no rules. So you have to know when to break the rules, and you can do it on rare occasions. I don't think we ever broke that in Airplane. And we never did it in Naked Gun. I mean, maybe you could think that Leslie going on the outside of the wall from room to room could have been a little bit like that. But we never have anybody, you know, look at the audience.
Look at the camera.
Yeah. Right. But there's sometimes when the gag is so strong that you can do it. And I just love that interaction that we predicted. We could predict the audience's reaction.
Oh, that's great. No, because what I love here, that, as you said, that every time I hear a rule about comedy writing and I can find the exception to that rule in one of your movies and say it works perfectly.
So, yeah, and you do. And so we do say you can, you know, there's rules for, it works 90% of the time, but there are no rules. And one of the things is, you know, breaking the frame. Like you can't, maybe that's part of that rule. You can't make the audience aware that they're watching a movie. But at the end of Blazing Saddles, for instance, Mel Brooks, you know, pulls back and they show the cameras and the studios and the light, the whole soundstage. So, and he gets away with it. And part of it is because it's at the end of the movie.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's
And he shows the whole Count Basie orchestra when they play the score.
No, that's a high anxiety, right?
Is that in high anxiety?
I thought
that was in Blazing Saddles. Maybe
no, maybe there's a Blazing, but yeah, that's a gagging high anxiety when it's a tense moment.
Yeah,
and the music is very Hitchcockian.
Oh, he says, "What's that?" He says, "French horns."
And the bus with the Philharmonic rides by,
right,
playing the.
Maybe he's done that gag in several of his movies.
He might have.
Right.
One more gag. Okay. Short gag, because it's topical here for Israel. We're just before the holiday season, so
okay.
this is from Top Secret. That's only three Jewish guys from Wisconsin could write this gag.
They are holding my daughter. They'll kill her unless I complete the Polaris mine by Sunday.
Sunday? That's Simchas Torah.
And the day the entire NATO submarine fleet passes through the Straits of Gibraltar.
That's a gag that I think only in Israel people would laugh in.
Probably, yeah. Or if there's
or a Jewish community.
All Jewish audiences in Cleveland, I'm sure they'd get it. But
okay, you know. So Jews and humor.
Yeah.
What's that all about?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like from the time, from the Marx Brothers, classic outsider humor. The Marx Brothers were playing a lot to an immigrant community, and you know, Chico played an Italian immigrant, and the three of us being from Milwaukee were not only Jews but outsiders, because you know all the sophisticated humor was coming from New York and L.A. or Chicago. So, you know, we felt comfortable being the little boy who said the emperor has no clothes. And so, that's in the way the Jewish experience.
Yeah, and making Jewish jokes or jokes in Hebrew or Yiddish or the Jewish folklore in your humor, is it something that that you would do happily because of, you know, I don't know, the heritage, or you would say, let's tone it down because people just won't get it?
No, we just did it where we thought it was funny if it made us laugh. You know, later when I did the scary movies, it was kind of beaten out of me by Bob Weinstein, any instinct to do a Jewish-oriented joke, because he said, you know, it's only, you know, 1.5% of the population, you know, nobody will get it. He hated that. Mm-hmm. So we didn't do it. But, you know, we occasionally threw stuff in. I don't think there was anything in the Naked Guns. By that time, we were done with probably puns also. Yeah. But, you know, you have to kind of grow and change and evolve a little bit.
Another Yiddish joke from Top Secret, something that I use constantly for 30 years, is Hotel Geishlufen.
The Hotel Geishlufen, yeah. Because, yeah, you know, my mother spoke Yiddish and my grandmother, and, you know, they would say Geishlufen. Right. You know, it's time.
So, yeah, when I'm abroad, I'm looking for the Hotel Geishlufen, yeah, right, when I'm tired. Yeah.
And a lot of Yiddish that we remembered from my grandmother and my mom.
Yeah. Working with Leslie Nielsen on the Naked Gun series and Airplane, someone who's always playing the straight guy, the, yeah, serious guy. Yeah. He never tells a joke. He's always the serious guy.
Right.
How was that collaboration work with,
well,
you?
Well, it worked fine. You know, Leslie was always he always said he was a closet comedian anyways, and he was forced for, you know, most of his career to do these very straight roles. But he was kind of a clown at heart, and he would go around with this little diaphragm which made farting noises. Okay. And that was his sense of humor. He was a silly man, but, you know, very nice, a real gentleman, and just had this wonderful voice and delivery, which, right, commanded respect, and that's just what we needed to do the humor that we wanted to do.
Do you think that after he made the films with you, afterwards he continued to make comedies,
yes,
spoofs? Did he feel trapped in his persona?
He enjoyed being famous, being, although that wasn't his purpose, but he loved being in comedies, in movie comedies, whether they were good or not.
Right.
I mean, other directors started casting him in movies thinking that he was funny.
Funny, right.
I mean, he is funny, but he needs a script and he needs direction, like any actor.
That's one of the things that we found out when he stopped working with you and started working with others,
right,
that Leslie Nielsen in himself is not funny enough.
Right. No. And you know, just you need a director there. You need, you know, our scripts are important to us, and, yeah, you know, they're carefully constructed. So, and that it always worked when we had Leslie.
And if we're talking about the Naked Gun, O.J. Simpson.
Oh, yeah.
How was it to work with him?
Well, I will say that he improved with every movie. Until he finally became the most famous murderer of the 20th century.
Did you remain in touch after?
No, the last time I saw him was at the rap party of Naked Gun 33 1/3. I said goodbye. I sold him my knife collection, and I never saw him again. And that was never. I was always afraid to, you know, I would come up to a stop sign or a stoplight in L.A. and O.J. would be in the next lane and look over at me and recognize me. And what was I going to say? Like, hey, Juice, nice murders. I don't know. What do you say? Just, yeah.
I don't know.
I don't, yeah, think he's castable again in anything.
Okay.
But he'll be out of jail in October. He made parole.
Yeah. Maybe he'll call you.
I just thought I'd include that little news flash here.
No, yeah, we read it.
Oh, you read it. They get the news here?
Good, yeah. Good. Yeah. Ruthless People, which is a film I loved. Yeah. I love Ruthless People. I think when we talk about your movies, the movies about Abraham Zucker, not many people include Ruthless People in it.
Well, because it's so not our style. It's,
right,
not a spoof.
Okay, so how did you...
Well, after...
Why did you make it, and
after,
how did you make it?
After Top Secret, we wanted to do something different, because we thought maybe audiences were getting tired of spoof. Maybe they didn't want to see this kind of satirical, crazy humor.
Were you getting tired of spoofs?
No, we weren't, but we thought maybe the audience was. And so we wanted to try something completely different. And Jeff Katzenberg sent me the script to Ruthless People, which is a farce. And I read it, and I was laughing out loud when I was reading it. So I called up Jim and Jerry. I said, you know, you should read this. This is something we probably should do. And it was a real fun experience, you know, working with Danny DeVito, Bette Midler, Judge Reinhold, and the whole cast was really great. And then that was also I can't remember the actor who did Earl, who played Earl. It was his first movie.
I don't remember either.
I forgot, but he became a pretty big actor.
And it was one of the, you said Katzenberg, it was one of the first films that Touchstone Films produced.
That's right.
Disney label.
Katzenberg and Eisner had moved over to Paramount, to Disney from Paramount. And so this was one of the first comedies they did. They did another movie with Bette called Beverly Hills.
Down and Out.
Down and Out in Beverly Hills.
Yeah, with Richard Dreyfuss.
And so they wanted to do another one with Bette. Although we had a meeting with Madonna first, which was also a possibility.
Okay.
Yeah, so that was interesting. We flew to New York to meet Madonna.
So it's a film that you didn't write. The screenwriter is Dale Lawner.
Dale Lawner, yes.
Who wrote hilarious films.
Yeah.
Dirty Rotten Scoundrels and My Cousin Vinny.
Yeah.
Right. How was it to direct something that you didn't write, or did you rewrite it?
Well, actually, it was actually easier in some ways because it was more just straight actors doing the lines. And the farce was beautifully written. We did a rewrite with Dale, and we added that whole, you know, videotape plot. Okay. So we added that to make it a little more, to make it broader.
Okay. But did it shift you back, you personally, David, did it shift you back to making spoofs? Because afterwards you made mostly comedies.
Yeah, well, we just did farces. That. It was successful, but my first love was always spoof.
Okay.
And I wanted to do, you know, that kind of comedy. I wanted to do real gag comedy. So at that point, I got the idea, why don't we go back? And Police Squad was very funny, the TV show,
right,
which we did in 82. And why don't we make that into a movie? And that was unheard of, a failed television show, you know, making it into a movie. But we pitched it to Paramount, and for some reason they said yes.
And that became the Naked Gun. Right. With Leslie Nielsen, with O.J. Simpson, which we and that became also it's a trilogy, right? It became three trilogies.
So then the end of the last one, Leslie and Priscilla have a baby,
right?
So right now we're writing Naked Gun 4. We're trying to revive the whole thing.
Oh,
and so this will be the son of. Leslie Nielsen.
Son of Naked Gun.
Son of Frank Drebin, yes. Son of a Gun. Oh, maybe that's the title.
Okay.
Son of a Gun. how lame is that?
We will request the credit.
Oh, my God. I just thought up a bad joke. Okay.
Is there a chance to make Naked Gun 4?
Well, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, you know, I'd like to make another movie, but the movie business has contracted into only big stars, franchises, superhero movies, big budgets.
Right.
So what you need is a sequel. So I happen to have this Naked Gun franchise. So, but I don't have the rights to it. Paramount owns it. So the way to do it is to, you know, write it on spec and then take it into the studio, which is what the plan is.
Okay. And Jim and Jerry are on board, or is it
no,
your,
they're not,
your project?
They're not doing it with me because they have other interests. Jerry is working on a Broadway musical, and yeah, he's in New York working on that. And Jim is working on it. He has a foundation to cure epilepsy, so you know, into other things.
Okay. So do you think that there is a chance we'll see Naked Gun 4 in the next few years?
I think there is a chance. I mean, there's a decent chance. It's, the script is certainly funny, if you ask me.
Nowadays, you can go to Netflix and do it.
Right.
There.
Well, yeah, that's possible, but we have to go to Paramount first.
Okay. And so around this time, the trio kind of, you know, dissipates. You know,
yes.
Each of you go your separate way. Why did you...
Well, I think, you know, we made a hit movie called Ruthless People, and it never went into profit. And so we had to share one director's salary. And, it, you know, frankly, that wasn't enough, because by then we had all bought houses. So, you know, we had expenses. And so, and also we had different interests. You know, Jerry had an interest in directing Ghost.
Right.
And so he did that, and that was a wonderful movie.
Wonderful movie, I agree.
But it wasn't something that I was interested in, and I wanted to really develop Spoof, and Jerry wasn't interested in that. And Jim wanted to do Hot Shots. So we had our, you know, our separate interests, but we always have remained close friends.
Okay. You're still in contact? You have your own WhatsApp
yes.
group?
Oh, yes. We see each other every week, and especially during the football season, we all come to my house to watch the Green Bay Packer games.
Okay.
So.
And it's true what you said, which is, for me, it's interesting that Jerry chose to go on a drama.
Yeah.
He left comedy.
Ghost worked in part because it was also funny. Whoopi Goldberg was very funny.
Yeah.
So, but he.
But it was a hit because it was very romantic.
Yeah. And it was a huge hit. Yeah.
It was a huge hit and a movie I loved very much.
Yeah.
And afterward, he made First Night also with,
yeah.
I think Richard Gere was there, I think.
Richard Gere right. and Sean Connery.
Right. So he made those big budget
yeah.
drama films. And Jim continued with the spoofs with
Hot Shots. Yeah, he did
Hot Shots,
the Hot Shots series.
And then you made Scary Movie.
And then I did the Scary Movie series. Because
3, 4, and 5, I think.
Bob Weinstein called me. I had made one picture for him with Ashton Kutcher and Tara Reid called My Boss's Daughter. And I had gotten to know Bob, and he liked what I did. So although the movie didn't really perform, but when he couldn't make a deal with the Wayans brothers for Scary Movie 3, he called me, and the Wayans had done it R-rated, you know, very okay. raunchy. And I said, I'll do it, but I want to do it PG-13. And so he said, go for it. So
why? Why did you want to do it PG-13?
Well, because, you know, my kind of humor doesn't go in the direction of raunch. You know, Basketball was R, but I don't think we went far enough. And it's just like, I want to do real wit. And if you really can do real wit, you don't need that kind of raunchy humor.
The funny thing is that the Scary Movie series came after everything that you three of you made, Airplane and Top Secret. It was a spoof.
Yeah.
It was spoofing your films, and then you became the director of a series that was made influenced by you.
Yes, it was, and it was started by someone else, started by the Wayans.
Yeah.
And, you know, they made, you know, the first one was very successful.
I think that they tried to be the Zucker brothers, the black Zucker brothers.
Right, and we tried to be the white Wayans. So, and I had lunch with Kenan Ivory Wayans many years ago, and they did a movie called I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker, and it was very much pattern and influence after by Kentucky Fried Movie, and he said as much.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a very nice lunch, and not knowing at all that in the future I'd be taking over their franchise, because I just wanted to keep making movies, and you know, this was what was going on. So and we had a lot of fun making them.
Yeah. It was three films. I think you directed 3 and 4.
I directed 3 and 4 and produced 5.
And wrote, I think.
I wrote and wrote with Craig, with Pat Proff, 5.
Right. And you mentioned Basketball, and I wanted to talk about that
yeah.
too, because it's a team up from heaven. It's you and the guys from South Park.
Yes,
Trey
right.
Parker and Matt
yeah.
Stone.
Yeah.
how was that?
It was great working with them. And in fact, Stone and Parker ended up, they wrote half the movie. They're not credited on it, but they really took a real active part in writing it. But and they, I thought they were terrific actors, very excellent comic actors.
Right. And you were a fan of South Park?
Fan of South Park, yes. I loved it, yeah. And I still am.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah, as there's a right now, there's a couple of other guys that a group of other guys that are upcoming, like Stone and Parker were in the late 90s, and they're called the Impractical Jokers. And it's on True TV in the States. I don't know if they have it here yet.
No, but I don't know.
But people should check it out. It's the funniest thing on TV.
The Impractical Jokers.
The Impractical Jokers, yes.
Okay. That's about all the time that we have.
But I have
today.
So much more to say.
Yeah, but we have a couple of minutes more.
Okay. I was just kidding, actually. No, nothing more.
No.
But,
okay.
But you can ask it.
How do you find Israel after all these years? That
I love it. It's great. I never run out of things to do. I went to Caesarea and I hadn't seen that. There's stuff that I haven't seen before when I've been to Israel on previous visits, and went to Jaffa and I saw the usual sites in Jerusalem, and Tel Aviv is, you know, they're building new buildings everywhere. I mean, this is going to be a great city once they get it finished.
I don't think they ever will. They have been building it for about 110 years.
Yes.
Yeah, but I love it.
It's great.
It's evolving.
I'm having a great time.
So it was great having you here on the show.
Oh, it was my pleasure. This was fun. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. עד כאן סינוסקופ ברדיו קצה, תוכנית 144. אחריי גיא חג'אג', אתה מוכן גיא?
אני מוכן גיא.
אז רגע, אז נשים ג'ינגל, ותודה לדייוויד זוקר שהגיע, ותודה לאלון גוריה שבסוף לא דיבר, שמתי לך מיקרופון אבל לא דיבר. לא, נכון, אבל חשבתי שזה. ועד כאן סינוסקופ ברדיו קצה, תודה רבה מאוד 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 שבאתם. ג'ינגל.
Cinemascope.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's the radio.
That's the radio.
This is the radio.
That's a DJ.
Hi,
man.
It's a radio for speaking to God.
A radio signal from another world.